The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of November 26th, 2018. On this week's show, SB Nation's Spencer Hall will join us to discuss Texas A&M's 7-overtime victory over LSU and other less insane college football happenings. Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal will also be here to talk about the biggest soccer match in the history of Argentina between Boca Juniors and River Plate, which got canceled after an attack on the Boca team bus. And Slate's Jim Newell will let us know if he got suckered into paying $19.95 to watch Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson play something resembling golf for a winner-take-all purse of $9 million. Joining me in our Washington, D.C. studio, Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Stefan, I can get you to show up anywhere for $9 million.
Oh, for $19.95, you could get me to show up.
$19.95 million.
Correct.
It's a deal. Agreed. Shall we discuss college football?
Let's do it.
You ready? The first 2-7 overtime games in major college football history were both won by Arkansas in the early 2000s. Arkansas was then led by a quarterback, Matt Jones, who years later was found by a police officer in a car where he was allegedly cutting up cocaine with a Foot Locker gift card. After watching LSU lose to Texas A&M 74-72 in 7 overtimes, I can attest that the scene that I just described works as a slogan for college football overtime. College football overtime, it's like cutting up cocaine with a Foot Locker gift card. Joining us now is the author of the best-selling book, 101 Things to Do with a Foot Locker Gift Card. It's SB Nation Spencer Hall. Welcome, Spencer.
So, you know, the weirdest thing is that it sold as well as it did, despite 99 of those things being cut up cocaine with Matt Jones in a car.
Why do you need 100 and 101 once you've got that 99? So this college football season has been pretty meh in the suspense department. Alabama, Clemson, and somehow Notre Dame all ended the year undefeated. But on Saturday night and into Sunday morning on the SEC Network, channel 913 on my cable dial, things got weird. LSU coach Ed Ogeron got a quote-unquote victory shower via Gatorade when the score was 31-24, when there were still 91 points left to be scored. LSU also quote-unquote won the game 3 separate times before not winning the game. Your thoughts, Spencer?
That everyone's a hero for making it to the 7th overtime. That's really what I have here. Additionally, I always like to think that football players are really well conditioned for the average person. However, it's not the kind of sport that does well when you expose it to more stress, i.e. when you ask these people to do more things aerobically. This is my long way of saying that when people go, oh, well, you know, SEC likes to brag about having great defenses, no one's good after the 3rd overtime.
Which argues that when college football's rules geniuses came up with the idea of this modified overtime, they weren't really thinking about what would happen if it went to 6-7 or more overtimes. Mm-hmm. So should there be some changes here after that 3rd overtime? Should the rules change, Spencer, and how?
Well, they do change. You have to go for two.
You have to go for two, but that's not enough of a change. We need more substantive changes.
I think they should just keep moving them back, right? Like, if you are stupid enough to get to a 5th or 6th overtime, you start at the 50. That's it. Start at the 50. Then we'll start you at the opponent's 40. We'll just keep moving it back so that this gradually gets more and more arduous. And there's a concede option, right? Just concede. I think the one really good critique, Scott Van Pelt has it, of the college football overtime system is that we go from something that is timed to untimed, which is fair. I think that's just that's philosophically inconsistent. However,
what about punting to no punting?
Yeah, I mean,
what about just field goals? Back them up 5 yards until somebody misses.
Yeah, I object to that on like a DNA level. Kicking really should be eliminated from football entirely, right? I enjoy people who are hardcore, what I would call orthodox pro fans, who are like, that's not real football, right? Real football is winning 24-21 on a last minute field goal. Okay, since when are you so Euro that you're like, this is a real sport? Let's get the kicker out here. yeah, the soccer player. No, just there is no good way of ending a sporting event that isn't in regulation. No one does it well. Baseball's got one of the dumbest. Hey, let's play forever. Let's play forever. Let's make sure we do it by giving the opponent another shot. No, no, no. Let's be fair. You have to get to the bottom of the inning.
Now that Les Miles is back at Kansas, I think there is the opportunity that a coach at some point in the future will have a quarterback quick kick in a college overtime. With Les Miles out of football, that was off the table. But for those who are not familiar, what happens is that you get the ball at the 25 and you try to score, and then the other team gets a chance to match you. And this happened 7 times in the LSU A&M game. And the thing that that happened after this game, the thing that happens when you lose a game 74-72 in 7 overtimes, is that there were a lot of opportunities for that not to have happened. And so in the LSU fandom community on America's favorite website, Tiger Droppings, there's a lot of screenshots being shared of injustices that were visited upon LSU. There's a talk of secession from the Southeastern Conference. Mm-hmm. Anytime there's talk of secession, that you know it's been a good game.
Good word choice too.
Spencer, I do enjoy the like post game screenshot phenomenon by people who do not understand the rules of football, claiming things like illegal formations, and it's the bargaining phase of the post defeat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that LSU fans in particular have been aggrieved by several different officiating issues this year, so they are particularly sensitive to it.
There were bad calls in this game. There were.
There were many bad calls in this game. There have been bad calls about LSU. You know, officials, I think the card system in other sports really gives people a perspective on officiating. They go, it's yellow and that's judgmental, but the ref's going to have good and bad days. In football, everything is so prescribed that I think it gives you the illusion that the official will always be right. You know, the rule book is so deep and it is so very specific about the things it prohibits or allows that we don't have the same kind of leeway we give to officials in other sports, you know, and I don't think that's true. I think we probably should. But also there's this: LSU fans are just going to complain. They are. They really will. They'll be angry about it. But you know what? Anger doesn't cover it. It's a complaint. You're complaining and you think everyone's against you because that's LSU's culture. Everyone's, no one's a rival and everyone's on the list. And now that includes the officials.
Did you see the part of the game, or rather the post game, Stefan, where Jimbo Fisher's nephew allegedly punched LSU offensive analyst Steve Kragthorpe, who has Parkinson's disease, and then former LSU great and New England Patriots legend Kevin Falk jumped in and tried to break things up, and which was captured in a spectacular photograph?
I did see the photograph, yes.
Kevin Falk wasn't there to break it up. Kevin was there to end it. Kevin was there to finish things, y'all. He was not there to help. He was there to help him understand a few things. Because
there's no breaking up of fights in College Station after midnight. I know you want to talk about Larry Fedora, Stefan, as we all do. But my last thought on this is you should watch, if you haven't seen it, there's a video of Jimbo Fisher's nephew immediately after the game when Texas A&M is experiencing the sort of like jubilation that one feels after winning a 7 overtime game, where he approaches his uncle, the head coach Jimbo Fisher, in the tunnel, and like there's no audio but what you can see in like classic silent film fashion is nephew explains to uncle, who is head coach of Texas A&M, that I just punched a guy
in the pacemaker.
I just punched a guy in the pacemaker. Just the look on Jimbo Fisher's face is something to behold.
It's the last frame. And you know what it says? It says, I can't take y'all nowhere. That's what it's saying. It's like, I can't take y'all. Look, I come down here. I make all this money. I give you an opportunity. I get $70 million guaranteed. I do everything to elevate my family from the means in which we have come. And you come down here and you fight like the union told you to punch up a Pinkerton. That's what it was, right? Like, you come down here and you're just tussling like it's Saturday night in Morgantown.
Stefan.
No, no disrespect to Morgantown.
No, hey, dude, that's no disrespect at all. Put your dukes up.
You mentioned Les Miles earlier. He's coming back to college football. Mac Brown, it was announced on Monday morning, has been hired to replace.
That's our Larry Fedora transition.
Yes, it is. To replace Larry Fedora as the head football coach at the University of North Carolina. I don't know whether to get to Mac Brown first or Larry Fedora first. Maybe we should just start with Larry Fedora. Larry Fedora won a few games, lost a lot of games this
I've never
year.
Thought that that was his real name.
The Fedora part or the Larry part?
The Larry Fedora mysteries. It's undercover.
Well, that's what he's going to be doing next. Crimes. He's going to be writing a series of children's young adult novels. Fedora got some attention earlier this year when he said that football is under attack and there is no doubt there will be major decline in the country if football continues to be under attack. Can we play a clip? Let's play a clip of Larry Fedora earlier this year.
I fear that the game will get pushed so far to one extreme that you won't recognize the game 10 years from now. That's what I worry about. And I do believe that if it gets to that point, that our country goes down too.
Spencer, are these people just crazy? Or are they just so locked in their bubbles that they believe that their shit smells like roses?
Yeah, they're not sane. It's not normal, and it's not sane to do any of these things. By the way, Larry is a Lawrence, so he was not given the birth name Larry. However, that's his middle name. His real name, and again, I've never told a joke in my life. I've just told, like, this is actually what happens. You won't believe. His name is Herbert. His name is Herbert Fedora. So potentially Herb Fedora was fired, which, yeah, you'd go with Larry, right? Yeah, it's not doing what coaches do and living like that and putting such focus on a game as your primary living without any kind of perspective. You're going to see everything as a threat, won't you? Because what you're doing is inherently ridiculous. I've always thought that like when coaches are asked to defend what they do, you really don't want them to do that because it puts them in the defensive because there's not really a good argument for being paid as much as you're being paid to do what you're doing. And in addition to that, there may be some projection here on Larry Fedora. Preseason, the heat was on. It wasn't looking real good. The way that they've been is if they had a quarterback, they were probably going to win 8 or 9 games. And if they didn't have a quarterback, they weren't going to win half that. It turns out the latter happened, and I think he was probably feeling a bit defensive from the start. Going back to how he did overall, Larry Fedora really didn't do, I think, a whole lot better or worse than anybody else who's been the head coach for a substantial period of time at the University of North Carolina. I mean, he had a winning record there. He was 45-43, but frankly, that's about how everybody does there.
Well, Brown is 67 years old. His record was 69-46-1 when he coached from 1988 to 1997. It seems like hiring any of these men is aimed at one constituency, and that is the, you know, septuagenarian donor class that funds a lot of these programs to the degree that they like to be funded. You know, Mack Brown's not getting hired to go recruit a 17-year-old out of high school in Tupelo, Mississippi, is he?
Yeah, he is. But he's hiring the guy who's going to do that.
Well, yeah.
That's who you want. Right now.
So he's a figurehead.
He has always been a figurehead. I think the complimentary term we give is CEO, i.e. overpaid distributor and schmoozer. And that's really all they want. And I think that they know – this is a sad signal to me that UNC boosters know what UNC football is at heart, that UNC just kind of has to – even if they're at 100% of UNC's potential, what does that mean for them locally? Does that mean, oh, cool, we're the best football team in North Carolina and we're on the level of Virginia Tech? That's where they're at. They're never going to be a Georgia. They'll never be a Tennessee, actually, in terms of like the overall commitment to football. They've had a better record than Tennessee over the last 10 years. However, that's not the point. The point is, as good as it's going to get, you're not going to get anybody to stay. Like, think about Mack Brown. They had Mack Brown. And what did Mack Brown do? Mack Brown went to Texas because the ceiling was higher there. And eventually the money was going to be better and the talent was going to be easier to get. Right now, out of the top 50 recruits in North Carolina, how many are committed to the University of North Carolina?
Zero.
One. And his number is 49th out of 50.
Well, it's nice that that Mack Brown and UNC got each other on the way up and the way down. They missed that, like, whole, you know, the vertiginous top of the parabola. You never want to be there. But, like, with the Les Miles Kansas thing, it's an acknowledgement that the best that Kansas is going to do is be associated with someone who was good once. And, you know, that's you could do worse than that. Right, Stefan?
Sure, you could. But they're all – let's getting back to the idea that they're all crazy, because at that level, they clearly are all crazy. Should we talk about Urban Meyer, that kind of crazy, or should we talk about Dabo Swinney crazy? Which game should we talk about next? I think Urban Meyer. I mean, they crushed Michigan on Saturday. They scored more than 60 points. They didn't have the best season. They only had lost one game, but they, what, almost lost to Maryland, right?
Yeah, that'll ruin any season.
Seriously.
They lost by 29 to Purdue.
Yeah. And after the game, what does Meyer talk about? Ugh, the adversity. Poor Urban Meyer. He got suspended for 3 games at the beginning of the season because he executed, I don't know, bad judgment is one way of putting it. You know, horrific behavior in keeping a guy on his staff about whom there were serious allegations of domestic violence. But hey, yeah, adversity. The Ohio State University. Feel really bad for Urban Meyer. Hope they make the playoff.
Yeah, who wouldn't? This is, by the way, you can just – I've never lost by assuming the worst in a situation. And when this all happened, I thought, oh, he thinks he's the victim here. That was number one. And nothing that's happened since and has played out since has led me to think anything differently. And now legitimately thinks that the Michigan win – has canceled all of this. Mm-hmm. It's all good again.
So Alabama beat Auburn 52-21. They're going to play Georgia in the SEC championship game. I think Georgia could beat them, so could Clemson. They probably won't, but they could. And then it seems like the fourth spot in the college football playoff, whether it goes to Oklahoma or Ohio State, those seem like the two most likely candidates. That's just like a roll of being sacrificed to Alabama and Tua in the first round. So perhaps we will get to see Urban Meyer get his comeuppance. And really the only way it seems like Urban Meyer understands comeuppance, which is on the field getting destroyed by Nick Saban.
Yeah, no, you go back to saying, you know, Larry Fedora is insane and the coaches aren't very sane. That would be the only way Urban Meyer really, I think, will understand anything, is if it happens on the field. And it won't, because I don't think you'll see a team as deep, as aggressive. And that's the different thing about this Alabama team. They are consistently aggressive. It used to be that Alabama would be very, very, very tight in the first, you know, they would be very tight in the second half. They would be looser in the first half and more aggressive. Now, you know, they came out in the third quarter against Auburn and just hit the afterburners. They did not pause. They did not stop.
Spencer Hall works for SB Nation. He does the Shutdown Fullcast podcast. He knows what to do with the Foot Locker gift card. Spencer, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we get to soccer, I wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, Stefan and I are going to talk about the concept of dues paying in sports media, whether it's important to earn your stripes by working for minimum wage while walking backwards in the snow. To hear that conversation, join Slate Plus for just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus.
The final of the 2018 South American Club Football Championship, the Copa Libertadores, had been hyped in Argentina as La Final de Todos los Tiempos, the final for all time. That's because the participants were two legendary clubs, Boca Juniors and River Plate, both based in Buenos Aires, both with crazy, passionate, intense, and sometimes violent fan bases. The violent part emerged on Saturday when River Plate supporters threw rocks, sticks, and bottles at the bus carrying Boca Juniors to the stadium for the second and deciding leg of the final. At least two players were injured by shattered glass. One reportedly got shards in one of his eyes. And when tear gas fired by police seeped through the broken windows of the bus, more players got sick, including former Argentina national and European star Carlos Tevez. South American and FIFA sportocrats tried to force Boca Juniors to play the game after a short delay. Then they agreed to postpone it until Sunday, and then Sunday came and the game was suspended indefinitely. Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal was supposed to cover a legendary match and wound up covering a legendary moment in the long history of soccer violence. He's still in Buenos Aires. Hey, Josh.
How are you?
Thanks for joining us. Your advanced story before Saturday's planned game and the New York Times' advanced story both led with the same anecdote about how announcers on a local radio broadcast were calling the game in calm voices with soothing music instead of crowd noise in the background, with a cardiologist in the booth to try to keep people from having heart attacks. This final was huge. I mean, huge enough for the Journal to send you from London to cover it. Can you sort of put into context how big a deal this game was?
This competition is 58 years old, and it's for the best teams in all of South America. And for the very first time, it turned out that those teams appeared to be the two hated rivals from Buenos Aires. This has consumed the city for weeks because it's played over two legs. And just to tell you the kind of national import that comes with these, a former president of Boca Juniors, Mauricio Macri, is now president of Argentina, and he said before the final that it would take the loser 20 years to recover from this.
So one aspect of this game that's fascinating to me is the notion that these teams and this game is somehow more authentic than European football. The head of the South American Federation said, this is real football. The Champions League is PlayStation football. And my sense, Josh, is that that's because the players on these teams aren't that great. Like, other than Tevez, who I think many listeners will know, these are not guys who are of high international stature. Most of the great players from Argentina will go to Europe. And so the stars of these teams do not actually overshadow the identities of the teams. And so it's less about the players on the field and more about the identities of these clubs. And so the fact that the players aren't that great, I think, feeds into the notion that this is real football, that this is something bigger than soccer. Do you agree with that?
I think that's a big part of it. And it speaks to the larger point about the economic imbalance between South American soccer today and European soccer. I mean, as money often does in entertainment, it's sanitized a lot of European soccer. So, these teams that we encounter a lot in the Champions League no longer see themselves as really representing a neighborhood or a section of the city. They talk freely about being entertainment companies who see their rivals not as each other, but Disney or Amazon. I don't think you could ever get Boca Juniors to say, yeah, we care more about competing with Disney than with River Plate.
And at the same time, what that feeds into is that the culture that pervaded European soccer for decades, the working class notion, the acceptance of violence, the difficulty that authorities had in controlling it and eradicating it, still exists. There have been more than 90 football-related deaths in Argentina in the last decade. And while officials of CONMEBOL, the South American Football Federation, and others said after the events of Saturday that it was just a few misfits. I think that was the word that the president of CONMEBOL used over and over again in a press conference. There is, this still does permeate the sport in a way that it doesn't in Europe anymore, or at least in England, Italy, Spain, Germany anymore.
Absolutely. And what happened over the course of the 80s and 90s, especially in England, was that club owners seeking to change fan behavior did two things. One, they priced out a lot of the more working class fans that they believed were causing the trouble. And we can agree or disagree on that. But that was one strategy they approached. And the other was improving the buildings themselves, because they figured if the building is nicer, and I've had owners tell me this about, I think even things like bathrooms, if they're nicer, fans are less inclined to rip out the seats. Here, the infrastructure is incredibly old. Rivers Stadium is more or less as it was when it hosted the 1978 World Cup final. We're still talking about concrete bleachers. Fans were running in because there are no assigned seats in most of the stadium. So it's very much retained a sort of pre, I would say, 90s feel about it.
Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned, Stefan, that in Argentina, there's a rule over the last few years that a bunch of clubs, including these two, their visiting fans are not allowed to go to the away stadium as an attempt to try to curb this violence. And because of that, a lot of the action, it seems, is going on outside the stadium, on the way to the stadium. I'm curious, Josh, you know, is your sense that this is a small number of fans, a bunch of misfits, as Stefan said it before, or is the issue here, are the people who are causing this violence, is it widespread? Are we talking about thousands upon thousands of people?
In this particular case, it wasn't thousands who attacked the bus, but there is a wider acceptance of violence in the football culture here. People kind of expect it. And often, it's not just violence between rival sets of fans. There are rivalries within the same groups of fans. Different shades of what are called ultras, or groups that see themselves as either more authentic or have different political alignments. I mean, within a single group of fans, you could do a whole sociological history. And as you rightly point out, away fans were banned from traveling at every Superliga game and at all the top-tier Argentine games since 2013. They lifted that ban partially ahead of this season, but kept it in place for games involving the big five Buenos Aires teams, which is why there were no Boca fans at River this weekend. And they had their own open practice as a kind of send-off to the team last week at their own stadium that drew 50,000 for a practice.
The last time Boca and River played in the Copa Libertadores was in 2015. It wasn't the final. The game was abandoned at halftime because fans of Boca managed to pepper spray River players in the tunnel. Like, they managed to sort of infiltrate the stadium and attack the players. And on Saturday, I read, about 2,000 police deployed, but they also let the Boca Juniors bus drive down a street that was a place where River fans congregate. And apparently it was not the normal route that they would take to the stadium. And the police containment was poor. There were hundreds of fans there throwing, you know, and again, that small band of misfits, however many it was, but clearly the bus was attacked, period. How on earth, you know, and what does this say about how a game like this is regulated in a place like Buenos Aires, that they could even get close enough to the bus for this to happen?
Yeah, well, without getting too deep into Argentine politics, there is a lot of tension between local police at the moment and the justice ministry, issues over funding and staffing. And so what happens is you get situations like this where the police is being accused of not properly handling the event or properly managing the crowds. And we saw, even after the attack on the bus, they were running battles outside the stadium on Saturday between River fans clashing with police over, we're not sure what, but a situation where there was this anger at the game being called off. There was this anger at a perception, at confusion, really, that was reigning everywhere. And it came out sort of in a whole bunch of forms.
Our friend Ken Bensinger, the author of the book Red Card, about the Justice Department investigation of international football, had a great Twitter thread over the weekend talking about how a lot of what's going on in Argentina should also be about the state of the economy and the state of the political leadership. And there are people there that are sort of encouraged violence in society as a way to undergird their own power. How important do you think those factors are, Josh, being down there and witnessing what you saw over the weekend?
I think there's obviously already a lot of underlying anger here at the state the country is in. But as you say, rightly, the encouragement of violence, not always explicit, it's kind of assumed. And my sense is that it's a very, it's seen as kind of a viable solution for expressing yourself and for acting out rivalries, as we've seen between Boca and River.
So this final is going to be played, allegedly. It must be played. The game must go on, right? Have you heard anything, Josh, about what the plans are? Do you have any speculation around when and how this match will be played and under what conditions? Is it possible that it could be played at an empty stadium, as has been done at games in Europe in the past, for sure?
I already thought for sure that when the first time they tried to play it again, it would be in an empty stadium here at River on Sunday. I was surprised when they decided not to do that and invited all the River fans back, because at that point, there's really no punishment for the club. Maybe something down the line, but hey, we're just going to try this again. Everybody come back and we'll see what happens. Clearly, that didn't happen, because there was no game. Now the CONMEBOL, which is South American soccer's governing body, is going to meet Tuesday in Paraguay at its headquarters and decide or attempt to set a date and a place for this. There may yet be disciplinary repercussions as well. But I'm not confident that this game will go ahead anywhere, if ever. CONMEBOL has the opportunity to make a statement now and punish River, potentially by throwing them out of the competition. But there is another time limit at stake here, which is December 12th, the FIFA Club World Cup starts in Abu Dhabi, and South America needs to send a representative to that, a team, normally it's champion. So sometime between now and December 12th, they need to either have this game and find a champion on the field, or kind of pick one. And there are no guarantees that this game will go ahead, that it would go ahead in Buenos Aires. Clearly, Buenos Aires, this game has shown it's almost too big for Buenos Aires. Whether they decide, all right, let's fly both teams out to Abu Dhabi, where the Club World Cup is going to be, and sort it out there, is another matter. But then you have to get River to agree to that. It's a real mess, and the CONMEBOL is not going to come out of it well, no matter what happens.
Well, none of the sportocrats come off looking well after this. CONMEBOL and FIFA officials apparently were trying to pressure the team to play, for Boca Juniors to play on Saturday, when like a half dozen of their players were vomiting, gagging, or in the hospital. And again, this reflects the sort of classic arrogance and disorganization that you find in the sports bureaucracy at the highest levels.
Absolutely. FIFA's official position is that its president, Gianni Infantino, never pressured anyone to play. But even if he didn't say anything, his very presence certainly adds a consideration for the CONMEBOL president, who has to look over his shoulder and think, well, this guy traveled all this way, and we're about to show him that we can't handle a major final. That's not a great look for him either.
Joshua Robinson is a sports writer for The Wall Street Journal. He's the co-author with Jonathan Clegg of a book that is coming out in a couple of weeks. It's called The Club, how the English Premier League became the wildest, richest, most disruptive force in sports. Josh, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply. And now we move on from a sporting event with incredibly high stakes that didn't happen to one with stupendously low stakes that did happen. And boy, did it ever happen. The match between Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson. This wasn't just the match between
TM.
This was the match, quote unquote, has been touted for months as a mano a mano, winner take all $9 million face off between the two greatest golfers of their generation, or at least a face off between the greatest golfer of his generation and Phil Mickelson. In the lead up to the event, Tiger Woods did his best to sell it, as in this appearance on TNT's Inside the NBA.
Tiger, I think one of the things that everybody's looking forward to as far as the match goes is the fact that everybody's mic'd out there, the fact that there are going to be these side challenges, side bets in the course of the 18. Can you get in Phil Mickelson's head?
Well, I've been in Phil's head for 20-some-odd years.
And then when the balls were in play on Friday, it was a debacle. Debacle-ish? Debacle-adjacent? It was in the debacle conversation. Joining us now is the world's biggest Tiger Woods fan, Jim Newell. Jim, was your fandom worth $19.95?
Well, I think there's going to be a refund, right? Because they got the tech all wrong. So it'll be worth, will have cost $0.
But
so
you did
it was worth it? Oh, yeah. Well, I was at home, so my mom paid for it.
So in the run up to the event, Jim, you were talking all big about, oh, I'm not going to pay for this.
When was I doing that?
I mean, I don't know if you were doing it in that tone of voice, but I feel like you, I feel like you were making the claim that you were like above shelling out, like you were too smart.
Yeah, we all knew how that would end though.
So you did end up watching. Stefan and I think both watched the highlights. How bad was it, really? Like, did you have to be there to truly appreciate how bad it was?
No, I think you could tell just how bad it was just by watching it. I mean, it was, you know, neither of them have clearly played in a pretty long time. They're pretty rusty. Yeah, the level of golf was pretty bad. The putting was especially terrible. And, you know, I mean, they're lucky that it came down to such a close finish in the end. Otherwise, it would have been completely unsalvageable. Just, you know, after the first couple of holes, it just got a little boring there going on. Just the level of golf was so bad. And you were just watching, you know, it's not like there was, as you said, there weren't very high stakes. So you're just watching these two older guys who didn't have their A games taking a walk around Las Vegas. And, you know, all this hype about the side bets. One, I didn't understand why we were supposed to care about the side bets in the first place.
Drama.
Like, yeah. And, you know, so they did like – they did a couple closest to the pins and they did that, you know, whether Phil would birdie the first hole. And that was pretty much it. And then it became a very close match between two guys for $9 million. So they didn't actually want to have distractions or banter.
The organization of this was predicated on the past. Tiger did a lot of these. I mean, 7 or 8, right? In the late 90s, 2000s.
Yeah.
Where he was at the peak of his game. People believed that there might be some interest there in watching Tiger Woods play. But this is not then. I mean, this feels like you said, two middle-aged guys who are past their prime.
Well, the other thing was like
out on some bullshit that the media is going to buy into.
Well, the other thing was when these like primetime made-for-TV match play golf things happened, whether it was like Tiger versus David Duval or Tiger versus Rory McIlroy. These were on like free network television. Mm-hmm. And so the notion that this Tiger versus Phil thing was something that people would be willing to pay for, that it was unprecedented, was just totally bogus from the beginning. Tiger versus Rory back when it happened, that wasn't that long ago. That was in like 2012. Was more kind of exciting or interesting than this Tiger versus Phil match, because Tiger and Rory had never really done anything like this before. Rory is like the young up and coming guy and Tiger's the old vet. And so just this premise didn't really make any sense from the beginning.
Yeah, I think that it would have been better if it almost would have been better if they weren't playing for anything. I mean, granted, if they weren't playing for anything, neither of them would have done it. But then there wouldn't have been this, you know, this tension and the silence that happened on the entire back nine where they're trying to win all the money, and they could have just, you know, screwed around a little bit more. Because that was, I mean, to me, it was just having them mic'd up and having them talk was supposed to be the one thing that would be really interesting, not the side bets or anything. And they started off, you know, I don't know, I guess Tiger apparently went to Fred Couples' house the day before for Thanksgiving, and they were just like talking about that, and that was fine. But then, you know, it just – another problem was a lot of the times they were talking and the announcers would just start talking over them. And it's like, what are you even doing? You know, you were hyping up all this banter the whole time and you're just talking over them.
Can we listen to a little bit of Phil and Tiger failing to make a side bet and just the amazing drama?
Oh, yeah. That was something.
Low score and a hole from here for two. And given that I'm spotting you 40 yards, what kind of odds are you laying?
No odds. You either take it or you don't.
Don't let him bait you. Yeah, at least one.
3-2 odds, I'll take it.
No.
Well, what you did get a sense there of, what the main highlight of this was that you couldn't get in any other venue, was heavy breathing. It was pretty much 4 hours of mic'd up heavy breathing whenever they walked up a hill.
In analyzing their personalities, too, this feels like a terrible fit. I mean, regardless of their perceived animosity or their periods of frostiness over the last 20 years, Phil seems like such a striver, like he's trying to be liked, and Tiger, with his sort of dispassionate distance, didn't seem like he cared at all, certainly in the lead up to this thing, and I gather during the playing of it too.
Yeah, I think Phil in the last year has just turned into this sort of weird clown brand that he's now trying to build up as much as he can, like this crazy, reckless gambler who might just, you know, hit moving putts or who knows what he'll actually do, and then try to prove that that was actually the, you know, scientifically proper thing to do. So he's sort of, I don't know, he's sort of become this character. And I think Tiger feels a little bit of a need to, you know, show a little bit of a nicer side, you know, now that he's sort of working on his legacy a little bit. But they're still just completely different people that, you know, this idea that they would just, you know, be bantering all the time seemed a little forced.
Well, there have been allegations that Mickelson has a gambling problem, right?
Yeah, which you can see pretty clearly when he's saying first thing, you know, in the press conference 2 days before, like $100,000 on that I birdie the first hole. And then Tiger says, double it, you know, and he says, I baited you just the way I wanted you to, you know, just the way I wanted you to say it.
Did he take the bet?
Yeah, he did take the bet. And then, of course, he, you know, didn't birdie the first hole.
Well, it was all canned, though. So that's the fundamental issue with this. It's an insult to everyone's intelligence except Jim, who paid the $19.95. It's this notion that this clearly manufactured, made-for-TV event, that there's something important or weighty about it. And no matter how much money you throw at it, no matter how much you literally show the pile of money on the screen during the event, it's a big, big-ass pile of money, that you're going to convince people that there's something significant or weighty or monumental about this. It's an insult to everyone's intelligence. And what Darren Revelle said, and I think this is probably true, is that this broadcast was significant for sports leagues that want to figure out how to integrate live gambling now that gambling is legal in the U.S. outside of Vegas, gambling on sports, that they want to figure out, how do we have banter about gambling? How do we have live gambling action during a broadcast? It's kind of a test run for that. So this was presumably very interesting for sports executives, if not for the audience.
Yeah, as a data gathering operation, it was probably useful in that sense.
But was it? I mean, how far did it push? I mean, beyond those couple of, you know, ooh, I'm going to bet you $100,000 that I'll birdie the first hole, or will you take this bet? No, I will not take this bet. I mean, what did we learn then about whether there are ways to integrate gambling into an event
there were all
like
sorts of, like, you know, on every shot, there were odds at the bottom of the screen about, you know, who would win or who would put it on the green first, or those sorts of things. Like, there were people probably, like, gambling addicts just gambling the entire time on every situation.
There were live odds that they were showing on the screen that showed, like, real-time data about how people were betting. It was also sponsored by a betting firm. And so this could presumably be – the live betting is a thing that will happen.
Right.
Or at least that – leagues, once they get over themselves, will want to happen.
So, well, they'll probably and a way to do it in a different venue. They can sort of segregate this, right? If you can do a show that has a bunch of sabermetricians talking about baseball apart from the regular broadcast, you can certainly do a separate broadcast for people that are interested in the odds and live betting where the NBA or Major League Baseball or the NFL gets a cut.
Sure. And this is it'll be a leap to do something like this on a real sporting event. The thing that I keep coming back to is that this was a fake event and it had the real athletes and they had all of the hype and they wanted to make it seem as real as possible so the betting on it could seem more legitimate, I guess. But the question is the future of this kind of integration of gambling, can it come to like an actual pre-existing basketball game, football game, golf match? Or will it be segregated into events that are specifically made for gambling? And would those things ever be interesting to people who aren't compulsive sports bettors?
Yeah. I mean, do they need to be? I mean, is it all right to just have these things set up for the amusement of, you know, what are essentially day traders, you know, just whatever's happening out there, just some exhibition, just gambling off of it the whole time?
Yeah. The problem is that there isn't enough traffic there if you're just using it for staged events. I mean, that's not where the money is. I mean, every league is going to want to generate billions of dollars in revenue through gambling. And that is going to be the point. And if you don't do it in your regular, real competition, then there's no point in doing it. There's not going to be enough of this sort of stuff. As a test case, sure. But that's not the ultimate goal.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in Vegas a while back now, this must have been like 5 years ago. I forget what casino it was, but there was real-time betting and basketball, like on free throws. You could bet on whether it would be a make or miss. And so the technology exists. The question is just mainstream network or ESPN broadcasts integrating it into, what's typically been a totally gambling-free, gambling-averse broadcast as a marketing mechanism so that the kids out there, Stefan, children like your daughter, mm-hmm. we'll be watching a game and be like, sports gambling, that's cool. That's what I want to do with my life, is bet on Phil Mickelson making a putt on 16.
Yeah. I mean, your kids could just be all, you know, just talking to their bookie the whole time when they're just watching Phil Mickelson. But I don't think this is ever going to happen again. So I don't know.
You think this destroyed pay-per-view golf
especially since they're going to take a pretty big loss now that everyone's getting a refund, I would think.
Pay-per-view in sports, Stefan, just feels so scammy. And in media, the trend in digital media is towards getting people increasingly to pay for the product. And there's like a legitimacy that's conferred on something like, oh, the New York Times, you should subscribe to that and give them money. That means that they're more legit. And everything in sports that you have to pay for is like some rigged-ass boxing match, some UFC where Conor McGregor does something racist, or like this thing. It's just curious to me that in sports, it doesn't seem as if it necessarily had to happen that way.
Well,
we're paying for sports events. It feels like if you're paying for it, it's automatically that means something is awry.
Well, you're ignoring the fact that this is how television evolved. I mean, we're paying
for cable
in our cable bills.
Poor analogy on my part.
And we're paying for, you know, for Major League Baseball's package to watch every game, or the NBA ticket, whatever. You know, so every model is moving toward this. This was just so explicit because this was the equivalent of, you know, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig barnstorming after the season in 1927.
I'd pay for that.
Well, I would have paid for that. I'd pay for that now. So this, it's just the phoniness surrounding this and the what appeared to be lack of interest on the part of at least one of the participants that struck me as so weird. I mean, in addition to the fact that, like, these guys don't need $9 million. They don't need to, like, buff their brands. Why are they letting their agents pressure them into doing this?
They would like it, though. I mean, they would like it.
Oh, someone is offering me. Yeah.
I mean, they'll take it, you know. Yeah. I think they felt a little bit, you know, the $9 million was enough to convince them a little bit to get into it.
Would $7 million have not been enough?
No. $7 million is a trash number. They would never have taken that.
$8.5 million. We'll do it for $8.5 million.
I
think there was actually a reason that, you know, I think they were thinking $10 million and then the PGA Tour, because $10 million is what the PGA Tour gives out for the FedEx Cup, so they were very upset. So they didn't want another number to overshadow, you know, golf's ultimate cash prize. So they settled on $9 million.
$500,000 a hole.
Of course. Yeah, this is why, you know,
pop, they ended up playing 22 holes though. So
this is why pop stars play concerts for dictators. And I assume the dictators are not getting, you know, their best work. But you'll show up for $5 million, $9
million. So you're saying you're equating dictators with gamblers.
Exactly. It's been a kind of a poor analogy segment for me, so I'm just going to roll with that. Jim Newell, congratulations on getting your mom's 1995 back. Congratulations to your mom for having 1995.
Verizon still hasn't announced if they're going to give it back, but here's hoping, Mom.
Did you tell your mom that it was going to cost $19.95 to watch what you were watching on television?
I just sort of ordered it, and then she came back. I was like, oh, look what's on.
Jim Newell, thank you.
Thank you.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student-athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. And I mentioned that there are five 7-overtime games in the Football Bowl subdivision, FBS, college football. One of them is a crazy outlier among the crazy outliers, which was that in October 2006, North Texas and Florida International played a 7-overtime game with the final score of 25-22.
What?
Yeah. You get the ball at the 25-yard line of your opponent 7 times in a row, and yet you can only manage a total of 25 points.
Well,
Spencer 22
was,
points.
Spencer was talking about how tired everybody gets. Maybe it was the offenses that were tired in that game.
North Texas led 5-0 at halftime.
Should have ended the game right there.
It ended. The regulation ended 16-16. The game was won in the 7th overtime by a kicker, because kickers are important no matter what Spencer Hall says. The kicker's name was Dennis Hopavac, and it was his 5th made field goal on 9 attempts in the game. Each team missed 4 field goals in overtime. But that's not important.
The kicker's retired, too, from standing around for 4 hours.
The important thing is that Dennis Hopavac was the hero.
Hero kicker. I love a hero kicker.
Stefan, what is your Dennis Hopavac?
Well, I was happily watching Tottenham thump Chelsea 3-0 in the Premier League on Saturday when, in the 85th minute, this happened.
Well, this should be a goal, and it is. And Chelsea have one back with just over 5 minutes remaining, and the meaty French forehead of Olivier Giroud.
My wife was watching with me, and we simultaneously asked each other if we had just heard what we had heard. Meaty French forehead of Olivier Giroud. Meaty French forehead. We were not alone in our stupefaction. I searched meaty French forehead on Twitter, and there were plenty of other viewers who were similarly confused by the call by Arlo White on NBC. The meaty French forehead of Olivier Giroud was a sentence I didn't need to hear. Meaty French forehead of Olivier Giroud. I don't know, Arlo White. The meaty French forehead of Olivier Giroud. Why on earth would those words pass through your lips? Did the announcer say meaty French forehead, or did I have a stroke? A little more searching revealed that I am, along with a couple of other dozen Twitter commenters, just clueless when it comes to Arlo White and Olivier Giroud's meaty French forehead. White first uttered the line to describe the French international scoring a goal with his head way back in 2014 when he played for Arsenal. Giroud, that is, not Arlo White. I believe this is the original, a 90th minute goal to rescue a 2-2 tie at Everton on August 23rd, 2014.
It's a good cross back in, the header comes in, it's the equaliser for Giroud! The meaty French forehead of Olivier Giroud has probably earned Arsenal a point.
He did it again in December of that year. The meaty French forehead of Olivier Giroud sends it into the corner. And a bunch more times after, including on an 89th minute equalizer against Manchester United in 2016. Here's one more because rule of three when it comes to clips. This is a game winner by Giroud in the 85th minute against Leicester City in August of 2017. The Men in Blazers duo of Roger Bennett and Michael Davies picked up on the call because it's kind of what they do and it's perfect for them. Earlier this year, they had Arlo White on their show, which is also an NBC property, and asked him about some of his more famous utterances like flamehead face-off in the center of the park, a feeding frenzy that reduced the cockerels, Tottenham, to a lifeless carcass. Here's Roger Bennett asking White about meaty French forehead. Roy Hudson, by the way, is another soccer announcer famous for absurd over-the-top turns of phrase.
Meaty French forehead, you know, flamehead flare-up or whatever it was.
Yeah.
You just have to go with the flow and whatever comes into your mind. Some days it's better than others, frankly, depending on how you feel. But I don't script big moments.
Meaty French forehead. Meaty French forehead. Mm. You don't have this giant book of Ray Hudsonisms on your bookshelf and you're like a book of spells. That just came out.
No, well, I've not topped it, and that was four seasons ago. So, no, I don't sit there and think of those phrases because I think then you're looking at a notepad instead of watching the game.
Michael Davies, though, wanted to know more about meaty French forehead. In particular, he asked White whether he believed that French foreheads are generally meaty or if Giroud's forehead is especially meaty.
It was the fact that his forehead is inherently French,
yeah,
but it's meaty. What is, get a word that would describe the fact that he can just thump a ball with his head.
It's meaty.
So it was just Olivier Giroud.
All right, so the question now is, of course, as with all sports catchphrases, whether meaty French forehead has run its course. When Giroud was entering a game last year, at NBC Sports Soccer tweeted, meaty French forehead alert in all caps, with two police cars revolving light emojis. There was just one reply, delete this tweet and your account. But I hope that White remains undeterred. While meaty French forehead does get abused a little, as you'd expect, by soccer people online, for Arlo White, it's a tiny catchphrase that's become an inside joke, and the risk of it spreading to other announcers is very, very low. White can't even use it that often. I mean, it's really only effective when Giroud scores a goal with his head. I mean, he could use it every time Giroud heads the ball, and I guess he's done that once or twice, but it's not as good. And Giroud is 32, his years in the Premier League, and therefore playing games called by Arlo White are probably numbered.
Sad.
Why is it sad?
Whenever days are numbered, it's sad.
Oh, yeah.
I don't like numbering the days.
Yeah. Poor Olivier Giroud. Maybe he'll come to Major League Soccer.
We could use more meaty French foreheads stateside.
Josh, what's your Dennis Hopavec?
It's the season of trophy games in college football. Your old oaken buckets, your Paul Bunyan's axes. Mm-hmm. Love false pluralization because there's only one of each of those. Spencer Hall, who is getting a lot of attention in this After Ball segment, rightfully so. He tweeted about a trophy that I did not know about and I'm now happy that I do know about, which was the UAB Memphis Rack of Ribs Trophy. Indeed, the UAB Sports website noted that the 2006 UAB versus Memphis football game will usher in a new tradition in the rivalry between the two schools. This year, the teams will be playing for a new trophy, a 100-pound bronzed rack of ribs that will be passed back and forth between the winning school each year. The article goes on to say that the theme of the trophy comes from the tradition of fine barbecue in both Memphis and Birmingham. Go figure. And that the Bones Trophy is being created by a sculptor named Heather Spencer and create that trophy she did. The trophy was 100 pounds. It has two rib-shaped handles, staying very on brand. It's 2 feet long by 2 feet wide. She used two slabs of beef ribs to make the plastic molds that would be then used to create the statue. This is courtesy of an article, this information from the Daily Orange website. She made the trophy in 2 months. She said, I don't think at first it really hit me what it was going to be for. Not really sure about that. Someone said, why don't you make a 100-pound trophy of ribs? We're not going to tell you what it's for. Just do it. She's like, sure. First, I thought this would just be an interesting project. A new challenge, she said. Instead, Spencer found herself overwhelmed, especially after seeing National Guardsmen watching over the trophy before UAB claimed it. There's a video on YouTube that has no sound. I was looking for something, maybe a clip to put in this after ball. There's just a video for 30 seconds of the trophy rotating. Just a 3D model.
Sort of like the log fire?
Just rotating. 30 seconds of 100-pound rack of ribs rotating. If you do want more, there's a Wikipedia article, not on the actual Wikipedia, but on a special Birmingham-specific wiki site about the Battle for the Bones, the annual college football game. I believe that there was, at one point, a Battle for the Bones regular Wikipedia entry, but that it was deleted, presumably due to a lack of notability, which is a crime, and Wikipedia's
it needs to be corrected.
Leaders need to be punished for their transgression. But anyway, this started in 2006. UAB won 4 games. Memphis won 3 before the rivalry was discontinued. There was also only one time in 2006 a barbecue competition that was associated with the game. The professional barbecue competition was won by Smokin' Buffalo. Well, the amateur competition was won by First Access Realty Bone Team. So congratulations to First Access Realty Bone Team. You really did it in 2006. The rivalry, the Battle of the Bones, was discontinued after 2012. Schools went into different conferences. UAB discontinued its football team briefly. As you might recall, the Bones Trophy has not been seen in years.
Really?
It needs to be revived so it can rotate.
Well, who won it last?
Memphis won it last, 46-9 in 2012.
So presumably they have possession of the trophy.
They're nibbling on it. They've been nibbling on it for 8 years.
Pouring sauce on it.
Nothing tastes better than sauce on bronze. Mmm, delicious. So the Battle for the Bones needs to come back. The Bones Trophy needs to come back. College football has not and will not be the same without it. That's our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.